some of the issues that we were confronted with whilst we spent a day on the Golan Heights. And Rabbi Gottlieb is your man to ask any question, whatever question. Please present some of the views, issues, and then we are read out the question. I
actually, I understand that they're sending out the book for Shechet to shech the cow, so he'll prepare the supper. That'll take about 2.5 to 3 hours. So you're really kind of disgusting. Right? Actually, we should be finished, not too difficult, not too long. I want to mention a few topics. I'll mention a few topics briefly and tell you what my position is on it, and then I'm happy to answer questions after the bus on the way back. Now, I guess we gave you a piece of good news. That film that we saw in Katrin, by next month, the front desk said that film will be replaced. That was good news. That film was really awful.
Tomorrow one?
Yeah, the tomorrow one. First of all, the picture of Rabbi Kiva taking upon himself to inform Eliezer that they excommunicated him and taking a slug of drink to fortify himself to go and do it, you know, that was really New York. That was not Rabbi Kiva. So, give me a break. I know you have to reach your audience and all that, but you don't have to take some of Rabbi Kiva and portray him as needing a drink in order to do something like that. They took the bare bones of the Gemara and, as they often do, turned it, twisted it in presentation to portray a position which has nothing to do with what the Talmud is talking about. What was the bottom line? The bottom line is that the majority rules even against the voice from heaven. So, what majority?
Sanhedrin majority.
Oh. Majority of what?
Not
majority of whom? Majority of which population? But he said it, and although it was mentioned in three words, it was very easy to miss. There was a confrontation on a train in Europe about 100 years ago. One of the great rabbanim of the time. Now, you know, our rabbis don't travel in any special outfits. They don't look like any other, different from any other Jew. Priest was sitting opposite him, and said to him, "I understand, Rabbi, that according to your laws, in the Sanhedrin, the decision was taken by majority vote." And the rabbi said, "That's true." So the priest said, "Well, there are a lot more Christians than Jews, Rabbi. So by your own rules, shouldn't you give it up?" And the rabbi answered, "It's only a majority of the Sanhedrin. It's not a majority of everybody. You have to be competent to have a view." Now, as two people mentioned to me after the film, what would a reformed Jew think seeing that film? Wouldn't he think that the Orthodox are the minority? And the reformed ones, the non-Orthodox, are surely the majority. Wouldn't he say that according to your own principles, Rabbi, shouldn't you recognize that the non-Orthodox are correct? But of course, nothing of the sort follows. Because it's only the majority of those who are competent to have a view. And it can be easily demonstrated that those other groups aren't competent. That's one thing. But there's another element that came out in the film, if you listen to me carefully, pay attention and thought about it, which is correct. And that is Jewish law is a matter of controversy from the moment it was given. This is what it really wants to imply. God gave it to us. that's not obvious. This is God's law. This is God's will. This is how he wants us to live. Now, any piece of information you give to human beings, there will be differences in a point of view about how to understand it, how to interpret it, and how to apply it. Especially if it's a complex body of law that's supposed to govern all aspects of life. It is inevitable that different people will understand it in different ways. Philosophically, there's another way to solve the problem. How can God ensure that people will live the way he wants them to live? And that is that God should continuously have input into the system. This is the solution of Christianity, at least the Catholic Church, who say that when a difficult, controversial issue arises, the Pope can get a direct pipeline from God to speak what they call ex cathedra, with God's voice, and therefore ensure that the new decision will be made appropriately the way God wants it to be made. That is one way, philosophically, that's consistent to handle the problem of how can God ensure that people will live the way he wants them to live when he gives them a set of rules and has to face the problem of the failures of human interpretation. The other way, which is the truth, the way the Torah is set up, that God gives us the Torah and he puts up with our mistakes. In other words, he gave us a Torah and he gave us a methodology. The methodology is that the Sanhedrin makes a decision. And even if, abstractly, according to God's original intentions in heaven, the Sanhedrin decides wrongly, we are to follow the Sanhedrin because he gave over the authority to making decisions to the Sanhedrin. And that's what the story with Rebbe Elazar of Yeshua illustrates. That Rebbe Elazar is abstractly correct according to the heavenly law, but we follow the majority of the Sanhedrin because God gave us a legal methodology that stands above the particular law, which says that when the majority of the Sanhedrin says it, that's what you have to do. And that's why, at the end of the quotation, God says, "My children defeated me, my children defeated me," and it says in the Talmud, he laughed. He laughed and he said, "My children have defeated me." Now what does it mean, "my children have defeated me"? Rabbi Yeshua, who said that we don't listen to voices from heaven, was quoting a verse from Deuteronomy. So who defeated who? He's quoting a verse from Deuteronomy. In other words, and this was said in the movie, that the revelation of absolute law occurs only once. The revelation from God occurs once. How do I know it occurs once? Because he said so. There's a verse in Deuteronomy that said, "Lo b'shamayim," the Torah is not in heaven. So the Torah's solution, God's solution to the problem, is to give it to us, and then to live with our interpretations and applications, whether they be right, abstractly, according to what he originally intended or not. That's how he gave it over to us. That's what it means that it's a gift. Saying the Torah is a gift is a profound philosophical principle. Now, this means that if you have disagreements about Jewish law, as indeed our traditions tell us, go back all the way to Moses, at any time, and you can have different sages who have different positions, sages of equal scholarship, equal integrity, equal brilliance, and their views are genuine, and they are part of the corpus of genuine Torah, and what we do follows the majority. That was as long as we had Sanhedrin. About 1600 years ago, we lost the qualifications for the Sanhedrin. Those qualifications include a line of ordination that went from Moses generation to generation, until the Roman persecutions, one of the things Romans did was make ordination a capital crime, and they murdered the great rabbis who carried it out, so that about 1600 years ago, the line of ordination ran out, which means we no longer have anyone qualified to sit in the Sanhedrin, and therefore those decisions can no longer be taken. What happens now? What happens now is that you have different authorities who are respected because of their knowledge, their integrity, their brilliance, and their courage and sacrifice in living the Torah way of life. And different communities follow different authorities. So the differences of points of view and differences in practice are inevitable and, at present, uncorrectable. I mentioned this to you when I talked to you about varieties of Judaism. I said that within the traditional community, You have different groups following different authorities, and every group recognizes that the other group is following a genuine authority and therefore doing acting appropriately. I want you to know, our last point of this subject, I want you to know that this is no different from any other subject. In physics, there's a giant controversy how to understand quantum measurement. There's no agreement on what it means, but each group recognizes that the other group, because it's led by brilliant people who know the whole field, has an appropriate point of view, and there's no way to decide. Unlike evolution in biology, where in evolution, each group calls the other group names and said that they're incompetent, that they're illogical, that they are fools. And in philosophy, where the same thing happens, where there's no respect from one group to the next, one famous philosopher wrote a book called Consciousness Explained. One reviewer said it should have been named Consciousness Ignored, because he held that the writer didn't even address the subject. That's how far out the controversies go. In our case, the Torah allows for differences of opinion and for the formation of differences of practice on the basis of genuine authorities. Anyway, that's a little bit about the film. Now let's talk briefly about the Golan. You saw today many reasons already why we should not give up the Golan. I don't want to repeat them, but let me answer some of the arguments that are made against. You have some generals and some politicians who said modern warfare is not conducted on the ground. Modern warfare is conducted in the air, through the Air Force, through missiles. This little piece of geography, 22 kilometers by 70 kilometers, you know, I think Manhattan is much bigger than that. It's a tiny piece of area. Cannot make any difference in an important all-out war. All-out war is not going to decide by this little piece of geography. That's a mistake. It's a desperate, tragic mistake. The point was made in the film, and I already get it a couple of times. We have been surrounded since 1967 by enemies on four borders. The quietest border since 1967 has been the border with Syria and Iran. Why? Is it because Israel has atomic bomb? Oof. Very good. Nobody's listening, huh? Yeah. Israel has atomic bombs, and Israel has missiles to fire them with. And Israel has atomic submarines. Israel has a deterrent for the Arab final solution. That's why the border with Syria is so quiet. No, because the other borders aren't quiet, and we still have the same atomic bombs. But the reason the border with Syria is quiet is because we are 40 minutes from Damascus. The road is open, and if the IDF wanted to invade the Damascus, it would take 40 minutes to get there. And they know that. So they don't want to give the IDF an excuse to invade and attack the Damascus. So they fight it through proxies in Lebanon, where we don't have such a capacity. The reason it's quiet is because the threat of conventional ground forces is there. In warfare today, the overriding concern is political. You have to be able to justify what you do and the amount of force that you use. Especially if you're a little country like Israel, leaning on a big country like the United States. So the fact that we have atomic bombs or an overwhelming air force is of no consequence. Because it may very well be that politically we can't use it. The reason we didn't take Damascus in 67, as Rabbi Geffen told you, is because Moshe Dayan said politically we won't be able to justify it. So we didn't do it, even though we had the ability to do it. So the quietness of this border is dependent wholly on the fact that it's indefensible for the Syrians, and therefore they're not willing to give it up. If we give them back the Golan, so then, incidents of their displeasure leading to retaliation of bombing the kibbutzim could open up very easily. Furthermore, these Arab regimes are all despotic. The statement of governments on record, several spokesmen said over the years that you can only make a binding agreement with a democracy. Well, there aren't any democracies. They don't have any model for democracy. the case, you're making an agreement with one dictator, the next dictator can act in an entirely different, arbitrary way. There's no reason for him to keep the agreements of the previous dictator. So it is really insanity to give back the Golan, indeed to make any concessions without any assurance that the concessions on the other side are meaningful. The Hamas now have said they're willing to make a concession, to have a temporary peace, what they call a hudna, but this time for several years, but they don't concede anything. They don't concede anything. Why did Absalom Assad not take Barak's offer of 98% of the Golan? Why did he say that in addition to us pulling down from all the heights, he has to have every inch, including the border of the Kinneret? Why? Because an Arab cannot concede land. On whose authority can an Arab give over Arab land to Jews? Or to non... It's not just Jews. It's just bad for Christians. They fought against three crusades. The crusaders held on to Jerusalem for decades. What was the attitude of the Arabs? The attitude was, you have it now, we will chase you out. It'll take 50 years, it'll take 100 years, we'll chase you out. They succeeded three times. From their point of view, this is only the fourth time. That's all. And they'll push us out a fourth time. Any agreements are agreements only in part of the longer struggle to push us out. You need to know that according to official Muslim ideology, the only legitimate state is a Muslim state. The only legitimate state is a Muslim state. Their religion divides up the world into three categories of people. There are Muslims, other monotheists who are not Muslims, and idol worshippers. Idol worshippers are to be eliminated. As indeed, wherever they expanded, they did. They eliminated them. Other monotheists can be tolerated as second-class citizens. And indeed, under Muslim control, unlike Christians, we were not systematically murdered. No Muslim could think of a final solution of murdering all Jews on the planet. That's not part of Muslim ideology. Indeed, in many cases, there were debates between Muslim doctors of religion and Jews, Christians, and philosophers without penalty. Unlike in Europe, where if you lost the debate and you didn't convert to Christianity, that showed that you were a criminal. And if you won the debate, that showed that Satan was helping you, so you're also a criminal. And either way, it was followed by a pogrom. No. Among the Muslims, there were open debates without bad consequences. But you have to be second class. You can't have your own state. You can't have a vote. You can't have your own independence. We just let you live. According to official Muslim ideology, the United States of America is an illegitimate state. England is an illegitimate state. Australia is an illegitimate state. Nigeria is an illegitimate state. The only legitimate state is a Muslim state. Okay, but what are we going to do about New York? Right? They're not going to go there and take over the United States. But right in the middle of the Arab world, to have a non-Muslim state, that's an abomination. It's an abomination. Would it be as if Rhode Island would secede and become conscious? I don't think that the United States of America would tolerate that. They didn't even tolerate missiles in Cuba. So the hope that they are going to accept us, that they're going to agree, that they're going to make a lasting, genuine peace, is poppycock. It's nonsense. It's part of the elaborate left-wing self-deception that everybody really wants money, and you can buy anybody up with enough money. People on the left believe this. Peres wrote his book about the new Middle East based on economic expansion and success. And I don't know if you remember a fellow named Douglas Fukuyama. American fellow who wrote a book in 1990 called The End of... I'm not sure it was a book, it was a paper. The paper was called The End of History. Listen to this, gentlemen, the end of history, no less. Why? Because he said with the collapse of communism, it was clear that liberal, democratic, capitalist countries are going to do better than everybody else. So everybody's going to become liberal, democratic, capitalist countries. And since that's what history is about. It's about the conflict of ideologies. And clearly, this social political system is the best. That's going to be the end of history. What a dreadful, short-sighted, simplistic, foolish view. 9/11 didn't figure in his view of history. Religion doesn't figure. Ideology doesn't figure because this guy, like the guys on the left, if you give him a bigger check, you can buy him off. The idea is there are truths that are more important than money doesn't figure in his view of history. Well, that means his view of history is just dead wrong. You're not going to buy off a billion Muslims with the promise of more coke, more jeans, and more videos. You're not going to succeed in doing that. Even the Americans who freed Afghanistan from the Taliban had to agree to a constitution which said they were going to have a Muslim state. A state based on its Islamic values. If not the Sharia law, which one of the clauses of the Constitution may bring in through the back door, they're worried about that. And Iraq is going to be a Muslim country. A Muslim republic. And Iran is a Muslim republic. And those who have non-Muslim republics are based on brutal repression, like Iraq was, and like Syria is. And Egypt, which tries to have a more neutral political stand, has the Muslim Brotherhood breathing down their necks and are worried to death that they're going to not be able to maintain their stability. So the idea that we're going to make peace with all of these countries, not a single one of which is a genuine democracy, and some of which are based on brutal dictatorship, and many of which are Muslim countries in their definition, is a pipe. That being the case, to make these kinds of painful concessions without any guarantees. So what should we take for our guarantees? That America will station its troops there? America's stationing of troops is as reliable as the latest government. And when public opinion shifts, and when they have to pay price for it, so that there's no way that we can rely upon it. Now, this is my last remark. Of course, it's getting out of here again. So people ask, what's the alternative? Gentlemen, as you know, I'm trained in logic. And this really drives me to the wall. Why must I have an alternative? Spoiler, they don't have an alternative. So then therefore your suggestion is better? In English we have a phrase that sometimes the cure is worse than the disease. But let me put it to you. Red-blooded, oh God, I can't say you're liberal Americans because you're too smart for that. But maybe there are some liberals here. I don't want to just shout it down. Tell me something. Is crime, organized crime, a problem in America? Do Americans suffer from organized crime?
They do.
Okay. So I have a way to stop it. Give the police more power. Give the government more power. Give the FBI more power. They can lick it. So you say, wait a minute, but I'm afraid about my freedoms. I'm worried about my freedoms. I'm worried about the liberty. I'm worried about the government taking advantage and using its power in illegitimate ways. Fine, you're worried about that. But what are you going to do about crime? What's your alternative for dealing with crime? You know what the answer is? The answer is, I've got an alternative. I'd rather live with the crime and maintain my liberties from an oppressive government than the alternative. I'd rather live with the problem. The Wall Street Journal, which is probably the only newspaper in the United States which is consistently reliable to have reasonable views about the Middle East, Wall Street Journal, in an editorial about 2 years ago, wrote, Israel has to look forward to 50 years of war. I think that's probably the most realistic thing that I've ever read about the current Israeli political situation. Israel has to look forward to 50 years of war. The Palestinians have trained their population and their children that the only acceptable solution to the conflict is that there's one state, a one-state solution, one Arab state from the Jordan to the Mediterranean, and Jewish self-determination has to be eliminated. So either it will be by piecemeal conquest, through suicide bombers, and through arms, or now, as Abu Allah has discovered, he says, you put up that dividing fence, so we're going to vote for a one-state solution. Because he knows their secret weapon, the Arab fertility rate, will eventually, one man, one vote, with a one-state solution, which means the end of Israel. Either way, the only solution that they recognize is the end of Israel. My wife has said for a decade, and others are beginning to wake up to this reality, who is the most consistent, principled leader in the Middle East? Yasser Arafat. Yasser Arafat is the most consistent, principled leader. He has his principles. He doesn't budge. He doesn't compromise. He doesn't bother to lie about them. He wants every inch. Assad is second, I think, a close second. They want every inch of the Golan, down to the Kinneret, and they're not willing to give up an inch. Not one inch, period. When Barak offered Assad 98%, he said, no, I'm not giving up 2%. When he went to Washington to negotiate with Arafat, and he said 98%, and Arafat said, no, I don't give up anything. Every inch is holy. Every inch belongs to us. Every inch is promised to us by Allah. We don't give up one inch. So that's where they stand. That's who you're talking to. That's who you're talking to. You're not the right of return. Those fools in Geneva. Left-wing Israelis and left-wing Palestinians who don't represent anybody. And they give up on the right of return. If any leader of the Palestinians would give up on the right of return, tomorrow he would be dead. They know that. The leaders know it, and the Palestinian street knows it. And therefore, at present, it's really hopeless. So I think that the only practical position for Israel is to sit tight, to make sure it has a strong army, to, I don't know what goes on in the back rooms with America, the extent to which America really is putting pressure on us, or whether it's for show. But I can tell you this, every time Israel makes a serious gesture in terms of making concessions to Palestinians, the leaders of the world's countries in private are hysterical at the stupidity of those supposedly intelligent Jews. Don't they know what the real score is? Don't they know what the real intentions are? How stupid can those supposedly intelligent Jews be? The real score is that they want you out of here. They want you to cease to exist. And they're not going to give up on anything less. And when they talk in private, that's what they say, the Arabs. And the rest of the world knows it. And they're waiting to see whether we're intelligent enough to stand up for what is ours and pay the price, or whether we're going to be taken in and lose what is ours and pay double the price. And Eric, that's the way it looks to me. Nasser, where are we holding?
Yeah?
In his mic.
And that's is it a good break or something? Okay,
back
for a stupid question.
You're a legitimate Palestinian state. And right now it's just peace. Palestinian is worth it. Sponsors it. So if you had a legitimate state in Palestine, I've heard from, I talked through some Palestinians I spoke with, it seems like the majority of Palestinians just want to raise a family. You have people that want to blow themselves up, that want to drive the Jews into the sea. So if you had a legitimate, why don't we work on setting up a legitimate government in Palestine that you can put people in jail?
I think that's a terrific idea. But now, what is Israel going to do to work on setting up a legitimate representative government in Palestine? You know very well that if we give our support to any Palestinian representation, it's automatically illegitimate. Then they collaborate. Well, I think the U.S. has really tried. I think the U.S. has really been pretty good. Okay, there are problems here and there with this move and that move, but I think they've been pretty good. And when they say that the criterion, Bush has really been pretty good. They've had some trouble keeping power in line from time to time. But basically, the line has been to be a legitimate government means to take care of terrorism. And the Palestinians consistently send the message, we're not prepared to take care of terrorism. Okay, so now the cards are on the table. They're not prepared to put in the one thing that would be a legitimate government. But frankly, I believe that America's done us a great favor by making that criteria. But for me, that's not good enough. Taking care of terrorism is not good enough. What? Putting it all under one umbrella group and creating a single unified command who together will instill in that Israel? That's not good enough. What Sharon has said consistently really is required. He says it, and he doesn't say it in any possible way. But look, what is it for? What about changing your textbooks? What about changing your summer camps? What about changing your attitudes? What about having a really democratic society?
Why are they allowed to buy those textbooks with American money? Why don't Americans send textbooks instead of checks and bricks instead of checks?
Because a textbook stamp made in America is already makes you a collaborator with Christian U.S. who are running a crusade to eliminate Islam. That's what's really going on over there. I don't believe you're right that the majority want to just raise them.
Yeah.
You look at the people who are these terrorists who blow themselves up. They are not. I once thought this, but I think I made a mistake. They're not the poor, the drug-ridden, the hopeless. The last one who blew herself up was a lawyer. The woman was a lawyer doing reasonable business and making a reasonable salary, especially for a Palestinian. She blew herself up. So I don't think it's correct. I think the ideology, Arafat is rumored to have said in one of his meetings with Barak, I can afford 10,000 suicide bombers. How many can you afford to lose before you give up? That was a good question. Yeah.
Would it be feasible for the reconstruction to take if Israel, if they realize it's a war, we realize what the score is, why not just put all these Palestinians on buses armed, and just dump them over the Jordan border? I mean, what would the consequences be? Because we're already at war anyway. We're already facing dealing with terrorists. We're already
In 67 we could have gotten away with that.
Yeah, 67.
Let me tell you something. My first trip to South Africa was 23 years ago. 23 years ago, the South African rand was worth $1.20.
Mm-hmm.
Today it's worth 18 cents. 23 years ago, the university in Johannesburg, the university called WITS, was one of the world's well-recognized universities. They told me, we're going to be here for 1,000 years.
Number 15.
I said, what about Rhodesia, Zimbabwe? He said, no, it's different for this reason, for that reason, we're going to be for 1,000 years. Nothing is going to change it. Yeah, 10 years later, it was down the tubes. It's very difficult to stand against the world. It's very difficult to stand against the whole world. There, they had no powers. We have an ally called the United States. In naturalistic terms, if we did what you said, then everybody would be against us. It would be a boycott, like it was a boycott against South Africa. In naturalistic terms, it would be very difficult to predict that we would survive. So what? The only way that I could justify it is by knowing that God told us we have to do it. I don't know that. So if in naturalistic terms it doesn't look good, I don't know that God told us to do it, very, very difficult to understand, to support such people. Yeah.
I was here 15 years ago. I lived here for a year. It's just crazy how the political climate has changed and how much more extreme it's gotten and polarized. But I think that a lot of it, like, there was a lot more left. And there was a lot more, like, Sharm el-Sheikh, all this stuff going on back then. And I think that after the lynching, this question, they lynched with two soldiers, and they put the hands over the blood, they took their guns, it was a whole community that was, taking their attempt, all the stuff that they did. It really, I think, for a lot of Americans, because the New York Times is definitely slanted against Israel. It's the first time they ever published, it was in the front page, they had pictures of it. And so I guess my question is after all that, something like that happens, why would the left still believe that peace is even possible? And then I have a second question, which is, I want you to be a prophet and just predict, 5 years from now, what's going to happen with Israel? Is there going to be two states, and what's going to happen with
Israel? I can't predict. I tried that 5 years ago. I know now how long that would have been, so I can't predict. I must tell you, there are people who, a good book for you to read, if you want to understand this, Paul Johnson wrote a book called The Intellectuals. There is an extraordinary capacity for self-deception in the left-wing intelligentsia. It's really extraordinary the extent to which people who are, in one respect, intelligent, can blind themselves to facts that are open in front of them on the grounds of their set of ideas. I grew up when there was a life-and-death struggle with communism. the number of intelligentsia in the universities who believed in communism and were preaching it, when the atrocities in Russia and in China were open pretty much for everyone to see, and they still persisted in this elaborate self-deception, pretending that Russia was the workers' paradise and that it was just and working for equality and all the rest, I think you'd have to have some kind of very creative, imaginative psychologist figure out how these otherwise intelligent people can be so ignorant and so misled about the true nature of the politics of the world. So I can't answer your question. And predict 5 years. I mean, Abu Ahmad spoke about going back to the one state solution. I must tell you, the level of politics in this area of the world, for sophisticated Americans, is primitive. Israeli politicians say over and over again, one of them said it last week, why do we allow the settlers to impose their will on the rest of the country? Now, you're talking about 100,000 people or 200,000 people against 6 million. You wouldn't hear that in Chicago. Why do we allow this tiny minority group to impose its will on the rest of America? Americans know that it's democracy. People vote in elections. They elect representatives. In the Congress, there's log rolling. You vote for me, I'll vote for you. It's all done by vote. It's impossible for 2% of the population or 5% of the population to impose its will on the rest. If anybody would say that in America, they would look at him like he was an idiot. You can't talk that way. It's inconceivable. But in Israel, we can talk that way. The level of political debate is challenging. And the level of what the Arabs talk about, they get away with murder. They get away with murder. And people listen to them and take them to debate the views in the United Nations. I mean, it's like 6-year-olds fighting with one another. Mature adults don't take it seriously for a moment. Right, last question. Do you think that we're going to need?
The really critical thing that is going on with having everyone in democracy around tyranny is how in the world would you really want things to happen on the democracy? In Turkey, it's like a lot of democracy.
Because it's a democracy.
Yeah. Okay. If they gave some good stake, is that viable?